if we set the bar high and we trust our students and we work with them, they will not just hit the bar, but they will pass over by leaps and bounds. And even when they're 8 and 9, if you treat them like adults and not students, if you treat them like people, what they give you back in return is jaw-dropping. It's just sometimes they're limited by, you know, our comfort zone. And this is a generalization, and, you know, I was guilty of this as well. But, you know, like when you're uncomfortable doing something, it's not going to happen. You know, the students will then be uncomfortable and it probably won't work. But if you're all in and you're like, we're going to work together to make this happen for your benefit, it generally does happen.
This is the Rethinking Learning Podcast. I'm Barbara Bray. Welcome to my conversations on learning with inspirational educators, leaders, and change agents. Welcome, everyone, to the Rethinking Learning Podcast series. I am so happy today. I have Ross Cooper here. We're going to talk all about project-based learning. You know I love this. Okay, so let me just tell you a little bit about Ross before he starts. Ross Cooper is the co-author of Hacking Project-Based Learning and the Supervisor of Instructional Practice K-12 in the Salisbury Township School District in Allentown, Pennsylvania. Isn't that the same one with Randy Ziegen?
Yes, you know, same district. So yeah. So Randy is my superintendent. Yes.
Oh, cool. And you know I interviewed Randy too.
Yes.
Okay.
Awesome.
So I've been following Ross, oh gosh, on Twitter for years. And I got to meet him face to face at EDUCON last year. We had to get our selfie. So we're going to put the selfie up. You know that, right?
Yes.
So he, along with Aaron Murphy, who's a co-author of his book, they even hosted a Twitter chat when we did it with Kathleen on personalized learning. So I'm so happy Ross is here with me today. Welcome, Ross.
Thanks for having me. And of course, Barbara, I've been following your work for years as well. And I just told you, I'm in the middle of your second book on personalized learning, and they're both wonderful.
Oh, thank you. They're both absolutely great.
So as somebody who's interested in inquiry and PBL, I love, you know, digging into personalized learning too, because there's strong connections between everything. Oh, so it's great.
That is so great. So I want people to get to know you, and I want to learn a little bit more about you. So I would like you to share a little bit about you, your family, and maybe about your background and how you got to be who you are.
Awesome. Thanks for asking. So I grew up in Connecticut, which is something just my close friends maybe kind of know, because I've been, I shouldn't say stuck in Pennsylvania, but I've been in Pennsylvania since 2001 because I went to college here. I went to grad school here, but I grew up in Connecticut, went through, in Trumbull, Connecticut was my hometown. And, you know, that's always important to me, because when we think about where we are now, like what got us here, you know, and what made us want as educators, what made us want to be educators. And as I went through the Trumbull school system, you know, it was probably your, I hate to use the word typical, but, you know, probably your typical school system. And it, for the most part, I just don't think it was for me. You know, I was one of those students, as you think as a teacher, you always have the group of, you know, creative students in your class who think outside the box. There's always a couple in every class, especially at the elementary level. I think they're very easy to pinpoint. And I was one of those students. So it was always like, okay, Ross is very creative, but he's not good at his schoolwork. So it's like they're speaking about both things as if they're separate entities, you know? And to me, that's saying, okay, there's only one way to learn, you know? So Ross has to fit our mold rather than the other way around. And my grades were okay. My grades were okay. But, you know, there, I think school definitely didn't bring out my full potential, because like I said, it was my job to fit their mold rather than the other way around. In fact, you know, something that's a perfect example of that was, you know, I used to always hold my pencil the wrong way. I still hold it a really weird way. And I went to these therapy classes for hours on end when I was in private school up until, you know, grade 4. And, you know, this thing they would put on the pencil to try to get me hold it the correct way. You know, and I think that's kind of, you know, it's a little thing right there, but it's like, okay, I hold it weird, but it works for me. Then of course, well, you're going to have problems when you're going to get older. No, you're not. I think that's a little bit of a metaphor, but I think it's a perfect example of how, like, okay, like rather than saying, okay, do what works for you, it's like, no, you need to conform to us. You know, there's other examples as well, but that's just a small one that, you know, sticks out in my mind. So I think it probably was about, I definitely in middle school, I decided I wanted to be a teacher. mostly because, you know, I had this attitude, a little chip on my shoulder back then. I still have one now a little bit, you know, like I wanted to do things better than the teachers, you know, who worked with me were able to do things. You know, I'm going to grow up and I'm going to be the teacher that the student like me, like Ross, the young Ross needed. That's a little bit of a generalization because I did have a couple teachers that, you know, saw things in me that I think other people didn't. But that chip on my shoulder made me want to be an educator. The only other thing I ever considered, anybody who's friends with me on social media at all knows I'm a huge foodie. So especially dry aged steak and pizza, preferably from New York or Connecticut. So I thought about going to culinary school at one point. You know, not a bad idea. Maybe I should have, maybe I shouldn't have. But I love what I do as an educator right now as a curriculum supervisor. So long story short, you know, I ended up, you know, going into education. Did some special ed as far as full-time jobs, half a year in third grade, 6 years in fourth grade. Absolutely loved teaching fourth grade in the East Penn School District. And it was just time to, you know, for change to make a bigger difference and to hopefully inspire more teachers and more students. So I became an assistant principal for a year. And then that landed me where I am now. I'm in my third year as a K-12 curriculum supervisor in Allentown, Pennsylvania. I think, you know, I did all things progressive as a teacher, whether it was tech integration, whether it was project-based learning, robotics, 20% time, all those great things, and, you know, inquiry-based learning. And now as an administrator, you know, it's different. It's as a teacher, you go to a conference, you learn something, you know, you can implement it the next day. There's other layers to implementation now. But I do my best to, you know, work with teachers, work with administrators to really try to get these things going in our district and in our classrooms.
Oh, they're lucky to have you. That's because I know what Randy shared and how your district is really moving. And it's probably a lot of the work is because of what the, you know, where you come from, too. And I was like you. I had everything going against me. I'm, you know, the red hair, short, left-handed, creative, never wanted to follow what everyone said. So I was like you, too. Maybe that's what happens to the creative people is they go, well, I'll show them, you know, kind of attitude later is that I want to be that teacher for the kids, you know?
Yeah, it's interesting. I think that my mind goes to the book, like Creating Innovators by Tony Wagner, mm-hmm. you know, when he talks about, you know, these innovative people and what got them to where they are now. And even teachers, like who are those really inspiring teachers that these innovators refer to as their mentors and, you know, they're outliers, you know, from the students to the teachers, it's, you know, a lot of these people are outliers who just kind of wanted to do things their own way, but more importantly, had the confidence to do their things their own way and really not listen to the naysayers. And that's absolutely huge. And that's what we want to instill in our students.
Well, that could be why you wrote your book, because you had all these ideas when you were teaching with Aaron and, you know, I have your book right here. I love it. I refer to it. I share it out.
Awesome.
I did give you a review, but it wasn't in here.
That was not my fault. We talked about that. That was not my fault. For some reason, I don't know what happened. I swear. It's not, your review is on my website, and it was so much appreciated.
Oh.
It's on my website. I don't know why it didn't make the cut.
Don't even worry about it. It's not really about me. It's about you.
I know you said that to me. You said that to me. I remember.
Yeah,
I go,
no,
I apologize to
you.
And you go, it should be the other way. I know I wanted your name in there. You know, I want a credible name. You do amazing work. And I don't know what happened.
No problem.
Just how it
so,
is.
You know, why did, you know, I know that you and Aaron share a little bit in here, but why did you decide to write this book?
I think there are a couple of reasons, to be honest. One of the reasons why is, you know, it's gotten to the point, sometimes, once again, I don't want to make a sweeping generalization, but you see more educators now writing books than ever. And a lot of that's because I think educators now have these platforms because of social media. It's very easy to blog. You can get a nice blog up and running in like 10 minutes. Instagram, Snapchat, even Facebook. It's easy to have a platform to attract people to your work. And then because of that, you know, it leads to you writing a book, but also independent publishing, you know, so you have Ed Tech Team, you have Dave Burgess, you have Mark Barnes, you know, doing independent publishing. It's very easy to do these things. Not, I shouldn't say very easy, but it's easier. You know, it's a lot of work to write a book, but it's easier. You know, I saw, you know, a decent amount of people doing it. And I just thought to myself, I'm selling myself short if I don't. So project-based learning was a natural thing to do. One of the lines that I love is, you know, simplicity is the ultimate sophistication. And when you know a topic so well, and I hope I know PBL pretty well at this point, that you're able to then communicate it in a very simple way for people to grasp it. Mm-hmm. You know, and I think it's one of those things where, like, if you're tackling a new initiative in your district, let's say Common Core Math, and you just memorize a couple articles and facts and you try to regurgitate it, it comes across as very convoluted and complex, and people are less likely to buy into it. But when you know the ins and outs of something, you're then very able to communicate it in a very simple way that people are like, oh, like, that makes sense. Like, I get it. Like, nobody's ever framed it like that before. And that's really what we tried to do. So it's like when you write, you know, you go through all the, and, you know, the book, or whether it's a blog post, you go through all these words and ideas to really convey something very complex in a very simple way. And that's kind of what we tried to do with PBL. We want it to be kind of less is more, very accessible. And we wanted people to read it and be like, oh, that makes sense. I could do that. That's not very pie in the sky. Like, why haven't I done this before? And granted, you know, PBL and a lot of education initiatives aren't easy, but hopefully we made it easier.
Well, you did. And in fact, what I like, and I think that because of the way it's set up, you know, the hacking books and how he asked, Mark asked you to do some of these things, but your structure was pretty easy the way you and Aaron put it. You wanted to design the, let me just say the whole title. Hacking Project-Based Learning, 10 Easy Steps to PBL and Inquiry in the Classroom. And I'm glad that you brought inquiry in. And the way you did the structure in each of the chapters really made it easy for people to follow through. Can you just kind of give it like a little overview of what that structure is?
A lot of it, our work with PBL, is we kind of look at PBL and sometimes it's like very abstract, pie in the sky. Like, students are going to be solving real world problems and that, you know, they're going to be breaking down the walls of their classroom and bringing in experts. And we think a lot of times that intimidates people. So a lot of our work with PBL, honestly, is built around the understanding by design framework. You know, the backwards design, which started with Ralph Tyler in the 40s, and then Grant Wiggins and Jay McTighe. Grant Wiggins is probably, you know, my education hero. I never got the chance to work with him, which is, you know, one of those life regrets. I never got to see Jerry Garcia in concert either, which is another life regret. So if you look behind me, there's a whole bunch of CDs. Those are all Grateful Dead bootlegs. The listener can't hear, but yeah. No, it's fine. They encourage bootlegging. So a lot of it's based on a very specific framework that is kind of, you know, was inspired by understanding by design. So thinking about the different steps is, you know, we wanted to make it as linear as possible, even though it's not completely linear. Like, we know nothing's ever linear and black and white, but we try to do it as much as possible. So looking at the table of contents, it starts by basically building that culture in your classroom of inquiry and creativity. It's really not like a set it and forget it. You know, so if you look at it, like, it's not completely linear. You don't establish your culture of creativity and then say, okay, now we're ready for PBL. You know, you start to establish it, but it's really established as a result of the success the students have with PBL. And that's kind of like, that was inspired by the work of John Cotter and Michael Fullan. You know, it's not just one of those things that you just do and leave it alone. Culture is not an initiative. It's something you're constantly working on in your districts, in your schools, and in your classroom. So you have that culture. Part of that, you know, hack number two is explicitly teaching collaboration skills. And this is something I was working on today with some teachers within my district. You know, when I first started teaching, put students in groups, they don't get along, you slap them on the hand. Slap on the wrist, I think it is. And you say, oh, like, you know, how dare you? You're not behaving. You need to get along. But we're not explicitly teaching them the steps to get along and to effectively collaborate. Because even a lot of times as adults, we don't know how to do it, right? And I would say that to my students. This isn't the game of school. We're not doing this because we're playing make-believe in fourth grade. Like, this is something that adults struggle with as well, but we're going to work through this with explicit strategies. And then from there, a lot of it is, you know, what content is worthy of PBL? Are we just like doing our favorite, you know, activity because it's that time of year? Are we pulling out the October folder and saying it's time for our Halloween activity? Or are we really, you know, focusing on those standards and those skills that our students need, wrapping your vision around those standards, generating your big takeaways, your enduring understandings, wrapping it in an essential question. And then, of course, you have your assessment, you have your feedback, you have your more direct instruction, which does take place at certain points throughout the project based on student need. And then eventually student publishing. And publishing, once again, isn't just one of those one-time things. If you think of it as adults, you know, our whole idea of publishing and reflection, we don't do it when we're completely done with something. We do it throughout the process. That whole idea of share early, share often. So like, when was the last time we engaged in a huge project and didn't share about its process in one way or another? So if we do it as adults, you know, we should be doing it with our students as well.
Well, I love the way, you know, you actually went through a lot of the hacks. I was going to go through a little, and we're going to go back.
Oh my gosh,
don't worry about it. Because what I saw that I really liked was you really took each one of those things that you just mentioned, and you had one section is what you can do tomorrow, which you really helped walk them through each of those sections, and they can share that and think about it and reflect on it. Because a lot of times teachers, they tend to look at the process. PBL is big for some people. And they look at everything and they think, oh my gosh, I can't do this. And they put the book away. You put it, mm-hmm. You broke it down into pieces, and you even put in each of these hacks, you put a blueprint for full implementation. Mm-hmm. And that, I think, because I was trying to figure, you know, I was going to write a book on PBL and you beat me to it. So yeah, that's okay.
Sorry.
I have a section in my own book, but that whole idea, I mean, Buck Institute has some wonderful resources, and they really do share a lot. And they also have some great workshops and strategies that they do, but not everybody can take them. And so they share a lot of resources, but the way you put this book is done in a way, it's not overwhelming. And it comes from two teachers who actually use examples. So I'm going to do another thing. I'm going to go back because you talked about culture, and hack number one is really that building that culture. And that's a big thing for me. I find that if we don't build the culture right away, you can't ever get it back, because the kids, they need that trust. They need the relationships, and they need to build that. So you actually talk about harnessing what kids, let's see, what was it? Develop a space that promotes risk-taking. Teachers are afraid of that. How do you do that? What do you say to the teachers?
So one of the things when Erin and I talk about project-based learning, it's almost like a lot of times you have these more traditional teachers or teachers who have never done PBL. And then it's like you're almost trying to retrofit your classroom. You know, it's like, I'm going to take this really progressive approach and stick it in the middle of a traditional classroom. It simply just doesn't work. And then when you do that and you find that it doesn't work, it's like, okay, the heck with PBL, like this is garbage. You know, and that's how you get this whole idea, oh, PBL is fluff, it doesn't work. And not just with PBL, but I think with anything. But I think a lot of it is, you know, as a teacher, we need to promote, if we expect our students to be taking risks, we need to be taking risks as well. So one of the things I used to do in my classroom, and people are kind of sick of it by now, is the marshmallow challenge. I know it's not as big of a deal now as it used to be, but you know, that's the whole idea. You're given a marshmallow, you're given some raw spaghetti, you're given some string, and you're given some tape. And I think students are given like 18 minutes to, you know, host up a marshmallow as high as they can using, you know, the materials that they have. And what's interesting about that is, you know, I used to get involved with the students and take risks as well. So it's not like I'm just sitting at my desk saying, oh, you need to take a risk. That's great. Like, you're modeling it. And also you're not only just modeling your physical activity, but also the, what, you know, that whole idea of metacognition, you know, what's going on while you're doing it and letting students know that it's okay. We also used to follow up. So like, you could take that and apply it to anything. So I'm using the marshmallow challenge, but you could take it and apply to anything. So I encourage teachers to get really hands-on with their students at the beginning of the school year, whether it's the marshmallow challenge or something else. Because that whole idea of productive struggle, risk-taking, iteration is absolutely huge. You know, it's really a culture of productive struggle and iteration. So there's that. But I used to also follow up with the TED Talk that came. There was a marshmallow challenge TED Talk. And in the TED Talk, he talks about how, I believe it's kindergartners are better at the marshmallow challenge and risk-taking than like CEOs of like Fortune 500 companies, because they're just not afraid, you know? And then we would talk about how we wanted to create that culture in my classroom. I used to show my students videos of Google headquarters, and we used to be talking about like, how can we make our classroom like Google? You know, we want to function like Google in our classroom, like a lean startup. Like, how can we do this? So it's you know, it's really intentionally doing it and going out of your way. I think a lot of times at the beginning of the school year, we do those like kind of like corny icebreaker sometimes, you know, the getting to know you. And I think there's a time and place for that. But you could kill two birds with one stone. You could do those activities where you're going to get to know everybody while at the same time laying that foundation for what's to come. And I think that's huge. Something that I would do now if I could go back into the classroom is I most likely would have my students start with an empty classroom and just redesign the classroom from the ground up. So earlier you talked about design thinking, right? I did a blog post a while back on reimagining your classroom with the design thinking process using the launch cycle by AJ Giuliani and John Spencer. So like how you would use the design thinking process to have your students design the classroom from the ground up at the beginning of the year. A lot of times you see classrooms that are like pretty and nice for Pinterest, but like if the students, you know, are our consumer, then they should be the ones that are helping to design the classroom because it's about them, not us.
So I've been a coach. I worked in Oakland School District, and I did that with several teachers in the middle schools. And when the kids came in, there was nothing on the walls and all the furniture was in the middle of the room. It was so fun. I mean, the kids are, and I do that. I actually do what you're talking about when I work with schools.
That's awesome.
Because I figure if they want to take a chance, they can all blame it on me.
Yeah,
go ahead, blame it on me, but just see what happens. So it's a lot of fun. So we've been kind of doing the same path. I've just kind of been doing it a little long ago because I figured it's all about ownership. It's all about student voice. And we also have to be vulnerable. We have to show that, hey, we're going to try something new today. Let's see if it works, right?
I think what happens is if we set the bar high and we trust our students and we work with them, they will not just hit the bar, but they will pass over it by leaps and bounds. And even when they're 8 and 9, if you treat them like adults and not students, if you treat them like people, what they give you back in return is jaw dropping. It really is. It's just sometimes they're limited by, you know, our comfort zones. You know, it's like a lot of times when things aren't done, it's not, and this is a generalization and, you know, I was guilty of this as well, but you know, like when you're uncomfortable doing something, it's not going to happen. You know, the students will then be uncomfortable and it probably won't work. But if you're all in and you're like, we're going to work together to make this happen for your benefit, it generally does happen. And I mean, what's the worst? You know, what's the worst thing that's going to take place, really? That's what I always say. So, but yeah, if you raise the bar, they will hit it and surpass it.
Well, the hardest part for teachers is they want to be perfect because they feel like they're accountable for everything. I wrote a blog post just recently called Accountability versus Responsibility. So make sure you see that. But I mean, you're like all the things I'm thinking you're doing. It's so cool. You actually did you had several blog posts that I kind of want to talk about because I could go on and on about your book, but I just want people to get it. I'm going to push this book out. It's just wonderful. But you had one on learning beliefs and how they intersect with PBL.
Yes. So basically with our school district, and you mentioned my wonderful superintendent earlier, Randy Ziegenfuss, him and my wonderful assistant superintendent, Lynn,
Funihetton.
Yeah, thank you.
She's amazing too. She's going to be on my show eventually too.
Yeah. Yes. Yes. So, with their lead, we have a profile of a graduate, and we have our learning beliefs, which we adopted from Education Reimagined. So that really, since Randy has become our superintendent, actually, I jumped into the district about a half a year after he became superintendent. And I'm always careful to say that because, you know, we're one-to-one district and so much of that work was done before I came there. So, you know, I always like to make that clear. But we ended up adopting the 5 learning beliefs from Education Reimagined. And those learning beliefs are socially embedded, open-walled, learner agency, personalized, relevant, and contextualized, and competency-based. In a sense, when I look at this, and I know you talk about this in your first book on personalized learning, I always look at like, what's the umbrella? And I love that term. Like, what is the umbrella that encompasses everything? And to me, it's when I look at those 5 different learning beliefs, it usually is personalized learning, right? That really encompasses everything. And under that, probably in a smaller umbrella, you might have inquiry. And then even in a smaller umbrella, you probably have like project-based learning. You know, in my mind, like people always ask like, well, what's the difference between inquiry and project-based learning? And, you know, so It's always interesting. You know, it's always interesting the way you look at it. But I think personalized learning probably covers more than you know, it encompasses everything, then everything else falls under it. When I look at those five learning beliefs, that's what I think, is that personalized learning drives learner agency. Like, learner agency could take place within the context of that learning, or open-walled, or socially embedded. So what we did was we look at these five learning beliefs, and we kind of ask ourselves, okay, like, they're somewhat abstract. You know, it's like, okay, it's great, but like, how the heck do you do it? And one way to do it is project-based learning, maybe more specifically, more open-ended project-based learning. So what we did was we had the teachers in our kind of our innovation group, we call it Your Salisbury, make explicit connections between the learning beliefs, our five learning beliefs from Education Reimagined and project-based learning. So what we did was everybody had a start of a mind map, which was the five learning beliefs. So right in the middle of the mind map, it said learning beliefs. And attached to that bubble that said learning beliefs, you had the five learning beliefs. And then attached to those five learning beliefs, we had them basically just go around and look at and kind of branch out the mind map while making connections to the different aspects of project-based learning. So basically, if you're looking at learner agency, what components of PBL does that tie into? Open-walled, what components does it tie into? And every mind map ended up being a complete mess, because it's not a complete black and white linear process. You know, there's connections all over, which is what we found. But the main thing to see, you know, it generated discussion, and it showed how, once again, PBL is a little bit more of a concrete vehicle in order to make these learning beliefs a reality in our classrooms. And it gave us the why behind PBL. We're not just going to do it because it's trendy. We're going to do it because it's going to help us to satisfy these things. It's going to promote agency. It's going to promote personalized learning and all those great things that we want taking place in our district. So basically, the learning beliefs are the why, and PBL is kind of like the way. That's you know,
the why and the way. Wow. I may even use that as the why and the way for, I'm trying to figure out for your title for this, because you have so much. It's not just PBL. You're really reaching, providing this culture and an environment for inquiry, for agency, for all of the things. And the projects, if it's done with project-based learning the way that you approached it, the kids own it. They want to do it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Hey, now that I think about it, maybe inquiry is the biggest umbrella. Maybe personalized learning falls under. I don't know. It's tough. I know personalized learning is a bigger umbrella than PBL, I would think. But maybe inquiry is like, I don't know.
Well,
maybe inquiry is bigger.
How about you and I come up with a real cool graphic around it? We can kind of play with it, because I'm writing about this also. And one of the things that I love is not just project-based. I love passion-based, and I'll talk to you more about this, but I went to New Zealand and I saw passion projects. Wow. That the kids, every child had to do a passion project, a whole year-long passion project. And there's other people, you know, that are on Twitter that talk about that. Also, people are saying, you know, personalized learning has a lot of different meanings. Maybe it's agency that we're talking about, that people are owning their learning, and they're self-directed, independent, and they're, you know, responsible for their learning. And so you could put, it's going to be an interesting drawing when it's all done.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's interesting how it connects. We always try to create a model for something, and like, we compartmentalize things, and sometimes things just don't fit in a model. Like, we're taking things and like, that's complex, and we try to simplify it. Like, you know, too much.
And
so yeah, I always look at like as inquiry as kind of the end all be all. That's my thing. You know, I just feel like inquiry needs to be taking place. You know, inquiry, literacy, and creativity are the things that like we want, you know, our classrooms to be dripping with.
Well, that sounds really good. Inquiry is about curiosity, and creativity is a big part of that. So it goes all the way back to when you were a little boy, and they just didn't know what to do with you. We want that kind of creativity for every child. So they really, we want them to be skeptical and question things and try to investigate, because it's so exciting when you see the kids do that.
Yeah, it's pretty phenomenal. It's interesting, you know, rather than being taught, hey, they're like looking for the formula or looking for the right answer, or just walking that, you know, playing the game of school and walking that straight path with a couple, you know, speed bumps here and there in order to get an A. You know, those are the things we want to promote in our classrooms for sure.
Well, I think because we could go on and on, but we're going to have you come back and we'll do some more about this another time. But I want to say that what I love is that inquiry is such a big, you really brought it back to where it's almost like, I don't even know what to say what it is, but the curiosity that you had as a young child, you knew you had to do that. And you knew this is why this was your passion and your mission. And that's why you are still doing this. So that's coming back out, is that whole piece of creativity and inquiry and bringing joy back into learning, which is what we need. So I'm hoping that when we put this blog post together, we might come up with something,
yes.
a drawing or something yes. that we kind of play with and then put it up there and let people just take it apart. But this was fun. Thank you so much, Ross.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. I could talk this stuff all day, so it's wonderful.
I know. So I know. I'm sorry that we kind of shorten it. You know, because I could go on in every direction. I could take every piece of your book and start talking about it. But like I said, we're going to put a blog post together and we'll share all the resources and some of the websites and the blog posts and some of the things that you're doing. We'll definitely to continue the conversations when we get together again.
Awesome. Awesome. So, are you going to EduCon this year?
I am planning on it, so I'm thinking about it. So we definitely will get together and we'll get to another selfie. So I'm putting our selfie up on the blog post also.
That's great. That is awesome.
Thank you so much. This has been wonderful. So thank you, Ross.
Awesome. Thank you.
Thank you, everyone, for joining me and Ross today on a wonderful talk about inquiry and project-based learning. Thank you for listening to the Rethinking Learning podcast and my conversation with Ross Cooper. Make sure you visit barbarabray.net to learn more about Ross and hacking project-based learning. Look for a complimentary blog post with resources and links where you can leave a comment for Ross. You see, these conversations are all part of a bigger picture to transform education. I invite you to leave a review on iTunes and share or retweet the post on Twitter using the hashtag rethink_learning and my handle, bbray27. Please subscribe to the podcast and the website at barbarabray.net so you can join the conversations.